It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. When we invite listeners to call in and ask a question or make a comment, we sometimes run up against the clock. In some instances, we're able to ask our guests the question we didn't have time for before they leave the studio. On occasion, we've been able to make those follow-up questions part of the show, as is the case with the questions you're about to hear. The first is from Brian and took place after our interview with energy consultant and distinguished research fellow at the National Defense University, James Clad.
One thing I have noticed and part in President Obama's speech and most recent news coverage is that seems to be that we're still very much focusing on 20th century resource-based energy production. We have GE coming out saying by 2015 we'll have a workable deuterium fusion reactor. We have companies investing millions of dollars wanting to capture near-Earth asteroids for resources, and I feel that these things have been almost glossed over. It's almost in the realm of science fiction, and I think that's sometimes hard to understand, but is this something that, not only as a country, but as a people, are we going to really start embracing?
Brian, I think you've asked, in some ways, a really telling question, and perhaps without intending it, shown us all that the spread of energy options is really growing. I mean, in a way, you're quite right. There's a 20th century feel to a sense that the energy world is defined by oil and gas, and everything else at best is a kind of add-on, a marginal thing, something that's beloved of people who aren't particularly realistic about how things happen in the world. I think that some of the stuff for example, the hybridization of the light transport fleet. I mean, this is underway now, the change of fuels. UPS has announced that an enormous part of its fleet is going to be working on compressed natural gas. And so I think really one of the ways that I try to see it is to say there are ideas out there, the fusion reactor is one, there are a number of other things relating to an entirely new way to achieve a solar energy conversion, that I try to keep those things in mind. And then because, I advise energy companies, I'm aware that these people are devoting huge amounts of money to hedge. And what I mean by that is they don't want to be left behind if one of these technologies takes off. So I think you've really put your finger on something, but I wouldn't agree, if this is what you were saying, that it's a world which can turn its back on the existing mainstays. And as I said a little bit early in the interview, I think it's something to do with relying on natural gas to help us bridge our way to the future where some of the options that you're talking about become feasible.
Okay.
Our most recent discussion of energy happened on yesterday's show regarding climate change. We asked our guests, Joylette Portlock, host and co-creator of the video series Do Something About Climate Change, and John Radzilowitz, director of science education at the Carnegie Science Center, starting with this tweet from Greg, who says, "Is it not true that the Department of Defense and the insurance industry already acknowledge and are accounting for climate change? Can't that silence deniers?"
Yes, they are. And hopefully that will help in the fight to convince people that this is really a problem. Both the insurance industry and the military have been looking at this for some years. And in fact, a few years ago, the term threat multiplier, I don't know if you've heard that term, was actually coined by military heavyweights talking about the effect of climate change on some of the world's most volatile places. And this really is a national security issue that we're dealing with when it comes to how climate change is affecting our security. And as far as operations go, I mean, that was something that I thought was very important in the president's plan to have the federal infrastructure, start taking a look at this and start being as energy efficient as they possibly can. And the military has been looking at that for years.
We have a tweet from Tour de Frac, and the comment is, "What do your guests think about the move to fracking, given that on the 20-year time frame, methane traps 78 to 105% more heat than CO2?
Yeah, it's the unfortunate thing about what's happening with natural gas right now. The burning of natural gas is actually a better alternative than what we've been doing. However, the extraction process is more than making up for what we gain there. So unfortunately, in the end, we end off no better off by fracking for natural gas than if we didn't.
Also, I'd like to add to that that if you look at the accounting of it, I mean, natural gas is still a fossil fuel. And though while the burning is cleaner, even if we switched over to natural gas for everything, we still wouldn't be able to meet the targets that the scientists are saying we need to be meeting as far as carbon pollution reductions.
Right. So even as a stopgap, it doesn't get us there.
So it can only, at the best, be part of an overall strategy to bring down our pollution.
And one last tweet from Jan, a comment. She says, thanks for the climate change program and for inviting only knowledgeable folks rather than presenting the bogus argument against science. And that certainly reflects positively on both of our guests. Thanks again to John Rodzilowicz of the Carnegie Science Center and Joylette Portlock, who has an independent video series on climate change, for joining us here on Essential Pittsburgh.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you very much.
On the heels of our Monday discussion on climate change and recent government policies, the Blue-Green Alliance, along with regional leaders, are working to develop a comprehensive plan responding to the national need for jobs. So how is Pittsburgh poised to take on green jobs such as renewable energy, manufacturing, transportation infrastructure, and more? And how can the Obama administration's climate change policies contribute to job creation? I'm joined now in Studio A by David Foster, Executive Director of the Blue-Green Alliance. David Foster, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Glad to be with you.
Also with us is Anthony Davies, Associate Professor of Economics at Duquesne University. Anthony Davies, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you for having me.
And if you have a comment or question for our guests, you can join the conversation by calling 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Our email address is esspgh@wesa.fm, and you can reach us on Twitter at esspgh and follow the conversation at #EPLive. I'd like to start, gentlemen, by playing a clip from a speech given by President Obama in April of 2011 in Fairless Hills, Pennsylvania, in which he outlined his vision for renewable energy in America and the jobs it would create.
Green jobs are the jobs of the future, not just because they pay well and can't be outsourced, and not just because they help strengthen our economy and lift up our middle class, but because they help us reduce our dependence on foreign oil and may just save this planet for our children. We've been talking about this for decades, but we can't afford any more empty talk. And that's why, as president, I will invest $150 billion over 10 years in establishing a green energy sector that will create up to 5 million new jobs, including jobs here in Pennsylvania.
And that was President Obama from a speech given in Fairless Hills, Pennsylvania in 2011. So, David Foster, with the Blue-Green Alliance, let's begin with you. Have we made any progress in the last couple of years? Are we making any progress towards realizing the president's vision of a green economy and green jobs? 5 million jobs, he mentioned there.
Well, certainly the president set a high aspirational goal, and given the opportunity to invest the amount of money that he projected, I think he certainly would reach that number. But looking at what's actually happened in the green or clean economy, it's one of the fastest growing sectors of the American economy over the last few years. In my home state of Minnesota, for instance, its growth in jobs in that sector has been twice, and in manufacturing, three times the rate of growth in other sectors of the economy. We've seen the complete remaking and retooling of the American auto industry along high fuel efficient electric and hybrid vehicles. That created 200,000 new jobs in the auto assembly industry alone. A million total jobs rippled through that. So I think whenever we examine any particular facet of what we generally call the clean economy, we've seen remarkable growth and great success given the burdens that we've had in the overall economy.
And when we mention green jobs, for people that are thinking, I might like to have one of those green jobs, specifically, what kinds of jobs are we talking about here?
Well, I've said for a long time that a green job is nothing but a blue-collar job done for a green purpose. And I don't think it's good to so politicized the language that we use that we don't really see the transformation that's taking place in our economy. We are moving down a continuum of being more energy efficient, relying more on renewable energy, cleaning up the processes that we work with. So we're on a continuum of getting to a clean or green economy. Now, where exactly we draw the line between what's a green job and what's an old job, I think it's important to see the direction that we're headed in and that we're headed to a place where, as Lou Schorsch, the head of ArcelorMittal Steel, said, our goal should be to make every job in America a green job.
Anthony Davies, as an economist, are we seeing an economic impact here with the creation of green jobs and the economy or the energy sector moving toward more forms of renewable energy?
I think that what we're seeing is less of an impact of the jobs themselves than an impact of the anticipation of the jobs, whether it be from green jobs or from natural gas. One of the things I think we have to be very careful of here is that the president is conflating two separate goals. One is job creation. The other is environmental protection. These are two separate, sometimes conflicting goals, and to address those goals properly requires two completely different sets of tools. One set of tools that as an economist, I would advocate for jobs is the free market. You let, rather than having politicians and bureaucrats decide what it is that we should be buying, you let consumers decide. You let entrepreneurs, you let investors decide what the next business is going to be. That historically has been the way to create jobs well. The other factor is environmental concerns. And if that is the concern, the way to handle that is by well-defining property rights. So if you have a firm that is throwing out lots of industrial gases, we define the property rights to make the firm responsible for cleaning those gases. But in neither of these situations is there economically a proper role for government to come in and start creating quote-unquote jobs.
When you talk about letting the private sector dictate how energy needs will be met, what energy policy will be, does the government not need in some way to step in, if only because if the energy companies, the oil companies, gas companies, what have you, if they are in control of how the policy is executed, isn't there the danger that we're going to have the kind of environmental problems, even though companies are trying to be, or at least saying that they're trying to be more proactive now and in the future about being responsible stewards of the environment, that nevertheless, if you leave, if you let the companies dictate what the policy is going to be, then you're going to end up with the kind of problems that we had in the 20th century that we're still dealing with now.
Yeah, this is absolutely right. And this is a bad place that we've gotten to where big oil in this country has come to rely on, you know, partly some government subsidies, government supports. And so big oil can divert government policy. And now, on the other hand, we have green jobs are looking to do the same thing, to use government favors, whether it be policy or whether it be subsidies, to divert the government's attention. Both of these models are wrong, because they're ignoring the one person who's able, actually the two or three people who are able to really decide where we should be going. And that's on one hand the consumers who decide how they want to spend their money. On the other is the entrepreneurs and the investors who decide what's a risk worth taking. These people have been pushed off of the table in favor of this dance between corporations and bureaucrats. And in that dance, the only person who wins are the corporations and the bureaucrats. The customers, the entrepreneurs, the investors are the ones who are left out in the cold.
David, is there one of the concerns about renewable energy is that it may not be cheap, at least at the beginning, as we see more and more of it, wind energy and other forms of energy being put into being connected to the power grid. What about the cost issue, and what kind of a bridge do we need to these renewable forms of energies, if any?
Well, I think we have a long history in our country of having a government that supports innovation, supports research, supports the development of technology. And many of our finest accomplishments as an economy, many of the reasons why we have the highest standard of living in the world today come because we've seen the value of this kind of proactive relationship between government and the future of economic activity. Had we not invested in some of these kinds of things, we wouldn't enjoy today the benefits of the internet, the benefits of the technology associated with the space program. The startup of virtually every new industry has come at some point on the benefit of government regulation, in some case, direct subsidization. We've seen with the wind energy, for instance, that it went from definitely requiring the support of tax credits and regulatory markets to now being the cheapest form of new energy, new electricity generation that we've got in the United States. If you're going to go out and create new sources of energy, wind is certainly one of your cheapest options today in my part of the country. So that argument becomes over. I do think that it's a legitimate question to ask about what is the role of government in creating jobs and providing environmental benefit. From my perspective, I don't see these two problems that we're facing as a country necessarily at odds with each other. Done right, they can reinforce each other. Done right, good environmental regulations, as we saw with the fuel efficiency standards in the auto industry, can be a powerful incentive for investment. We saw a Pittsburgh-based company, Alcoa, as a result of the new fuel efficiency standards for the auto industry, recently announced investments of $500 million in two of their premier rolling mills in Davenport, Iowa, and Alcoa, Tennessee. So this is the kind of market certainty that government can provide the marketplace so it unleashes what is today one of our biggest problems, $2 trillion sitting on corporate balance sheets that companies simply aren't investing because there are no markets for them to turn that productive capital loose on. So governments can provide important benefits for the free market system to run well and to run in a way that meets our environmental goals.
We are talking about the development of renewable energy and the creation of so-called green jobs today with a couple of experts in the field, David Foster, Executive Director of the Blue-Green Alliance, and Anthony Davies, Associate Professor of Economics at Duquesne University. If you'd like to join the conversation, 412-246-2002, the number to call. That's 412-246-2002. Our email address, ESSPGH@WESA.FM, and you can reach us on Twitter at ESSPGH and follow the conversation at #EPLive. We need to take a break. We'll come back and continue the conversation with our guests. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. And welcome back to Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer, and we are talking on the heels of our discussion yesterday on climate change and recent government policies, the development of a comprehensive plan for responding to the national need for jobs with green jobs. Are we in Pittsburgh poised to take on green jobs such as renewable energy, manufacturing, transportation infrastructure, and more? We're discussing this issue with David Foster, Executive Director of the Blue-Green Alliance, and also Anthony Davies, Associate Professor of Economics at Duquesne University. You can join the conversation by calling 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Anthony Davies, what are the energy options that you see?
Well, I mean, you know, the energy options are, you know, I think they boil down to sticking with what we have, which is basically coal, petroleum, natural gas, or moving on to something else, where something else is as yet undefined. And this brings up a larger question, which is, at what point do we make this transition from what we have to what we will have? And that question becomes really important because you can wait too long, and waiting too long means all kinds of things like, you know, we've developed this dependency on petroleum, whatever, it starts to run out, the price of gasoline goes really high, we pollute the environment, whatever it is. Alternatively, we can make the transition too soon. And too soon means we lock ourselves into a technology that ends up being inferior. A good case in point.
In terms of not meeting our energy needs.
In terms of not meeting our energy needs, in terms of costs, a good case in point is telecommunications. If you look at telecommunications in parts of Africa, they're far more advanced than they are in the United States. Why? Because they built their telecommunications system much later than we did in the United States. They've got fiber optics and cellular telephones, and we're largely stuck with copper cables.
David Foster, can we turn our backs on the 20th century energy mainstays, oil, gas, et cetera?
No, I don't think we can. And I agree with much of what Anthony just said about the need to not be the picker of winners and losers per se. But we do need to clearly define the objective. And if the objective is to do what scientists advise us is prudent, to reduce the amount of carbon in the atmosphere by 80-some percent by 2050, then we need to make that objective clear to the marketplace so that the new technologies and the companies that are investing in them can really compete with some certainty of knowing what the objectives are. And in that kind of a situation, will carbon capture and sequestration work to salvage coal mining? It very well may, but if we don't set that objective, then people aren't going to invest in carbon capture sequestration at the level necessary to find out if it commercially works. The same is true of wind. The same is true of various solar technologies. We were big supporters of a comprehensive economy-wide cap-and-trade bill that was passed in the U.S. House in 2009 because that's exactly what that kind of legislation did. It provided a framework in which big oil companies were essentially told, we have to become a clean energy economy. You have big pools of capital. Go be the best energy company that you can be. Stop being big oil. Start being big clean energy. So if we had comprehensive legislation like that, then I think we would have the free market acting at its best, competing at its best, providing the social outcomes that all of us want who believe in the environmental problems we're confronting.
So when do we get to that point where we, you know, clearly the goal of the Obama administration is clean energy, renewable energy. So at what point do we get away from the fossil fuels, the energy mainstays, and move on to wind, solar, to something that is clean and renewable?
Well, I think the Obama administration, if you ask them this question, would probably say that the president's plan is the best that we can do under these circumstances.
It sounds like he's just trying to get a start.
We have to start. We can't sit still. So let's do the things that the law enables us to do. Let's start the process of regulating coal-fired generation of electricity. Let's invest more in renewables and bring down the prices of some of those forms of energy and improve the technologies. Let's do one really smart thing, which is let's make sure that the appliances we use are at least at the level of efficiency that technology already allows us to do. You know, I put a new furnace in my house 3 years ago, and I was surprised by the fellow that came in. He wasn't Joe the plumber. He was Bill the HVAC guy. And he told me that if every single furnace like mine in the United States was replaced with furnaces like the one I was putting in, we'd reduce our energy consumption in residential homes by 30%. Now, that's crazy that we're just spewing out and wasting energy at that level in the country. So the president's plan is encouraging big investments in energy efficiency.
And we have three middle-aged men sitting here in this studio having this conversation. Will we see this? Will we get to where we're completely clean and renewable in our lifetimes, gentlemen? Anthony?
I don't see it, largely because, I have to take a step back here, because the world seems to divide people into climate believers and climate deniers. And I would say I'm neither one of those. I'm a climate skeptic. I haven't heard a convincing argument on either side. But David raises this statement that the scientists say we have to reduce carbon emissions by 80% by some year in the future. My understanding, and correct me if I'm wrong, David, is that even if Americans stop driving all their cars tomorrow, we couldn't achieve this, because largely the problem with CO2 emissions is coming from China and India.
Well, there's no question that we have a global problem, and that the problem is global warming, not U.S. warming, and that the goal of reducing our emissions by 80% by 2050 will succeed only to the extent that we're able to interact with our global partners and get the rest of the world to agree that this is a problem. Now, I think the evidence is overwhelming that the costs of inaction, whether you're Chinese or whether you're Indian, whether you're South American or whether you're living here in the U.S., far outweigh the small investments that it will take to start preempting this problem. Between 2011 and 2013 in this country, we had 13 major disasters that cost the country $136 billion. And my question has always been, why do we spend $136 billion responding to weather-related disasters when we can start preempting those, slowing down the rate of incidents, and using that money to create a 21st century infrastructure? And that's why the Blue-Green Alliance is so focused on its Repair America campaign.
And before we take the call, can you answer the question? Do you see renewable energy being our primary source of energy in your lifetime?
I see us going through a process of transition in which we continue to use some level of fossil fuels for a considerable period of time. Renewable energy has become a larger and larger share of the mix, and eventually we're able to hit the target that I talked about, not just in this country, but all over the world.
But not in our lifetimes.
Well, I'm 65 years old. I don't expect to see that process completed by the end of my lifetime, but I certainly expect us to be far down that path by 2050. I'm really just
2050. Yeah. Okay. That's good. We can put a date with it. So that's not terribly far into the future, some 30 or 28 years from now. Let's go to the phones, 412-246-2002. We have Carlana in East Liberty who wants to join the conversation with our guests, David Foster and Anthony Davies. Carlana, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Hi. I want to make the point that I think your guests are thinking way too small and way too slow. If you think about what happened in the United States of America between 1935 and 1945, these were big thinkers, and I think what we're dealing with today is very pedestrian. We've caved in totally to the fossil fuels to the point that we're begging the fossil fuels, oh, please help us become energy efficient and help us to use renewable energies when all of their investment is for fossil fuels. So we have cases like, you know, who destroyed the electric car, and they probably even have patents that they're sitting on that we don't even know about. But I think we have to look to Germany as a good example. The German beer makers have come out against fracking, so I think fracking even in Germany is going to get cut down because the Germans have made these big decisions for financing. It's a combination of the government and private sector making an investment in solar, for example.
Well, Carlana, let me jump in. It sounds like you are, and before I continue with you, I just you can tell I'm not a mathematician. 2050 would be 37 years from now. So I just wanted to make sure I corrected my bad math.
Okay, but let me just mention a couple of.
Well,
let
no,
me just
Carlana, we need to get to your question here. It sounds like.
Just let me mention that in Brainerd, Minnesota, they're working on an invention that of using sewer pipes to provide heat for buildings, their municipal buildings. And right here outside of Pittsburgh, we have a company called Epiphany who has developed a dish, a solar dish, that can bring water to 2,000 degrees. There's a lot of technology that is huge, and cities could be who have to replace their sewer pipes anyway could replace them with pipes that produce heat. We could be
all right, Carlana, I'm
going to
jump in again.
Thank
you for the call. Thank you for the call. And she hit on a couple of interesting points. One was that there are people who believe that there is a conspiracy that big oil companies, big fossil fuel energy companies, the energy mainstays, if you will, have conspired to prevent other forms of energy from being developed and becoming economically feasible. So what about this?
Yeah, it doesn't make
Anthony.
It doesn't make sense to me because, you know, if I'm an oil company, I'm looking at the inevitable, which is eventually we're going to run out of oil. I have a direct incentive to develop those technologies, not to sit on them. I think what's going on here, it's not a conspiracy amongst oil companies. Rather, it's a rational response of consumers. Gasoline today, as a percentage of the average American's income, is cheaper than it was in the 1980s. What's happening, and this is despite the fact that there are whatever it is, 5 or 10 times the number of drivers on the road that there were in the 1980s worldwide. What's happening is we're developing this resource in such large quantities that we can deliver to consumers at very cheap prices, and the consumers are choosing rationally to go with this resource rather than something else like electric cars, for example.
David Foster, what about this? And Carlotta mentioned the project in Brainerd, Minnesota. You are from the Twin Cities. So what about this project in Brainerd? And is this something you're aware of? And is it economically feasible?
Well, I'm not familiar with the particular project in Brainerd, but we do in Minnesota have several examples of what we call district heating, where we provide central power plants that then put steam out through pipe systems to provide energy, heating, and cooling to multiple blocks of buildings. We have one of the best district energy systems in the country in the capital of Minnesota, St. Paul. We have another great system like that in Duluth, Minnesota. We melt all the snow off our sidewalks with the heated sidewalks that are produced there. District energy and St. Paul, Minnesota produces largely renewable energy, 65 megawatts. We use the wood chips and trimmings from our park system. It's an excellent example of a city taking leadership in trying to develop renewable energy and use it to bring down utility costs for businesses and consumers alike. I want to say just a word about this issue of conspiracy, because I think it's quite a bit more complicated than that. We provide powerful economic incentives in our society to encourage people to go on doing what they're doing. And that's why I think it's so important that we look at this as a problem as citizens.
Economic incentives to continue.
For companies to go on making money the way they are, for consumers to go on spending money the way they are, for us to produce products in China, ship them across the Pacific Ocean in cargo ships that are belching some of the most polluting fuels in the world into the ocean. We don't charge for the economic damage that we're doing to the environment. And when you don't charge for a common problem to the individual causers of it, then you're never able to get the free market to function correctly. So we really have a problem with not charging the true cost of the carbon and greenhouse gas pollution that we have in the world. If we did that, which I would describe as a profoundly revolutionary act, then we would start seeing companies behaving a lot differently. I don't call that relying on companies. I call that the product of citizen activity, of politics at its best, of us having a good, thorough public policy debate in the country and the world and coming up with a solution that gives us the best of the free enterprise system and the environmental results that we want. Now, 37 years may seem like an awful long time to folks, but if we solve this problem in the next 37 years, we will be congratulated by the next three generations to come.
And you're referring to that 2050 mark, which
then
you would be, I believe, 102.
I don't expect to be around then.
Well, you never know if you take good care of yourself. But I think what you said might explain why our cars are still running on the same thing they were running on when the car was invented in 1905, and we've seen in the meantime so many developments technologically in terms of cell phones, satellites, computers, that there's apparently been, would you say, there's been a lack of incentive for people to develop other forms of energy?
Well, I don't know if there's been a lack of incentive. I think David is absolutely correct that, you know, if you've got ships that are spewing pollution, you need to hold companies responsible for that. And that actually is what a free market is about. It's not about doing whatever you want. It's about doing whatever you want, provided you aren't harming someone else. I want to go back to a point that David raised earlier, which is, he said, paraphrasing, done right, government intervention here can encourage development of alternative energy sources. I think the key phrase there is done right. What we have to be very careful of is government bureaucrats do not have an incentive to do it right, at least not an incentive like the free market does, where your own money is on the line, and if you do it wrong, you're out of pocket.
It's an interesting discussion, and one that we'll continue to be hearing in the region and throughout the nation in the coming years regarding development of green energy or renewable energy and green jobs. We've had our discussion with David Foster, Executive Director of the Blue Green Alliance, and also Anthony Davies, who is an Associate Professor of Economics at Duquesne University. You can read his work among other places, the Pittsburgh Tribune Review. Gentlemen, thank you both for being with us and having a fascinating discussion on Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you very much.
Coming up, business contributor Rebecca Harris takes a look at the state of manufacturing in the region. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA.
Yes, I feel a thing. I'm so green. I'm so